I am here to introduce our opening speaker for our first panel. This is the economics panel. We'll have a second panel on vertical mergers and vertical guidelines that feature lawyers, so this is the important one. We have a great panel, but I'm going to, because of the lights and the unpleasantness of those things, I'm going to have Steve Salop come up here and give his opening remarks. Steve is professor of economics and law here at the Georgetown University Law Center. As Commissioner Phillips said, his work with Sheffman and others on raising rivals' costs, as well as his work on VGuppy with Serge Morrissey, are really influential in terms of how people think about vertical mergers, foreclosure, and certainly we use these tools in the Bureau of Economics. And one of the things that I think we want to explore is to what extent, you know, should things like this be put in guidelines. So without further delay, Steve Salop.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, Bruce. Thank you, Commissioner, for setting the stage. I have a heck of a lot of slides, and this is going to save me several, so I really appreciate it. As I said, I've got a lot of slides, and I'm not going to have time to go over all of them. And so what I'd like you to do is kind of read along, sort of like a class, read along, and then I will highlight the issues that I think are most important on each slide. But to start, as by way of introduction, the key points I want to make are listed on this slide. Vertical merger should be focused on oligopoly markets. A lot of the criticisms one hears about vertical merger enforcement, why vertical mergers are competitive, relate to vertical mergers in either perfect monopoly or perfectly competitive markets. Second point, that I don't think that the analysis of vertical and horizontal mergers should be treated as inherently different in oligopoly markets. Vertical mergers, as I'll discuss, can lead to unilateral harms, can lead to coordinated harms, just like horizontal mergers can. In some sense, the vertically merging firms should be thought about as indirect competitors in the pre-merger world, and that indirect competition is eliminated. As I point out on this slide, in vertical mergers, the form is vertical, but the harm is horizontal. We're not talking about something that's fundamentally different. Another key issue is whether, and Commissioner Phillips pointed it out, whether there should be a pro-competitive presumption, in particular a pro-competitive presumption following from elimination of double marginalization. And I'm going to, this is a key issue, and there's a lot of disagreement on the panel about this issue. In my view, that the efficiencies from vertical mergers, including EDM, are neither inevitable nor necessarily merger-specific. As I'll discuss, the Kosian door swings both ways. Very often, efficiencies can be achieved by conduct short of merger. And in my view, and I think in horizontal mergers, and I think it's sort of generally accepted, that in merger analysis, only cognizable efficiencies get to count, and efficiencies are only considered cognizable if there are verifiable merger-specific and pro-competitive. And the burden in merger law and across all of antitrust is that the parties have the burden on efficiencies, not the government. And so my hope is that the vertical merger guidelines finally are revised after all these years, and that when they are, they should reflect this set of points. So the question, you know, should the vertical mergers be revised? Well, Commissioner Phillips laid out why they should be. The 84 guidelines are woefully out of date. I think we saw in AT&T Time Warner that courts are not very good at analyzing vertical mergers. In my view, the staff and the commissioners could get better at analyzing vertical mergers as well. And of course, it would be useful for outside parties, both the merging firms and their counselors. So what are the arguments against revising the merger guidelines? I've set out the standard arguments here. I'm sure we'll discuss them both in the economics panel and in the legal panel as well. One is that you don't need to revise the guidelines because, hey, we already know how to analyze vertical mergers. Then there's another counter argument that we shouldn't revise the guidelines because the issues are so complicated we couldn't possibly write down guidelines that are sensible. People argue the benefits are low because there have only been 50 some odd consent decrees. Actually, it's 58 through June of this year in the last 25 years. And the benefits are low because there shouldn't be any vertical merger enforcement. That's what someone like Professor Bork would argue. And that leads to counter-argument number two, which is the one I really like. And I think it's the one that lies below a lot of the points that people make under counter-arguments number one. The idea is that if you revise the vertical merger guidelines, that education is going to lead to more enforcement. It's an ignorance is bliss argument. Better we shouldn't know what the possibilities are because, the other way people put the argument is the staff will have a new toy and therefore they'll want to bring cases. And I think that's silly. I think that if we revise the merger guidelines, it will not increase false positives. Instead, it will reduce false negatives. Vertical mergers, moving on, vertical mergers, they include both purely vertical deals, but also complementary product deals. So a case like Ticketmaster Live Nation, they were not vertically related, they were both selling complements. Sometimes mergers are both horizontal and vertical. So for example, the St. Luke's case that the FTC brought, the Idaho Hospital case, the FTC focused on the horizontal aspects. At the same time, there was a private case that focused on the vertical aspects. The St. Luke's was taking over a large physician practice as well. Sometimes it's automatically vertical plus horizontal because one of the horizontal merging firms is already vertically integrated. So there was a deal 5-6 years ago where in the door skins market, molded door market, where Geldwin bought a small competitor, but Geldwin was both made the door skins and they also made the molded door. And that's a case where a private case in Richmond just recently undid that merger. Professor Shapiro was the expert for the plaintiff. Maybe he'll talk about that later. So wide range of deals that are vertical mergers. The basic economic benefits and harms, Commissioner Phillips laid them out, so I'm just repeating them here. I'd say in the foreclosure area, what I told my students when I taught this on Tuesday, that input foreclosure is the stronger foreclosure story than customer foreclosure. I don't think there's a lot of disagreement about what's in blue and black font on this slide. I think the economic arguments for both harms and benefits are pretty well known. I think where there may be controversy is what's in the green font, which are my views, that enforcement should be focused on oligopoly markets, that only cognizable efficiency should be credited, and that what you need to do is analyze the overall effect on consumers using a fact-based analysis of both harms and efficiencies. Okay. That's 22 minutes left. Okay, fine. Key policy issues. I think I have I've laid them out. The points on this slide are really key, but quite repetitive. The issue is the key policy issue is are vertical mergers so much less concerning than horizontal mergers that the legal and policy analysis should differ substantially. In particular, should vertical mergers be treated systematically? Should they be systematically more permissive than horizontal mergers, and if so, how? I don't think so. Would be my simple answer. Okay, so why? Commissioner Phillips said, hopefully we'll figure out how we should analyze the economics. And I'd say this summary slide, is really pretty important for my view of everything. So, in my view, the foreclosure harms, if we start with foreclosure, the foreclosure harms from vertical mergers are similar and not less inherent than the harms from horizontal mergers. The vertically merging firms are indirect competitors can be thought about as indirect competitors in the pre-merger world, and that indirect competition is eliminated. The V-guppy, the vertical guppy, was mentioned earlier. The vertical guppy looks a heck of a lot like a horizontal guppy, and that's because, at least the upstream vertical guppy, that's because the analysis is very similar. Vertical mergers are common. Vertical integration is very common, but so is horizontal integration. You know, most firms produce multiple products that are substitutes for one another. So that's not an inherent difference. Partnerships among competitors are common. Horizontal mergers are common. You know, the idea that are vertical mergers inherently pro-competitive? Well, so are horizontal mergers. The guidelines say so. We know very few horizontal mergers are disturbed every year. Also, vertical merger efficiencies are not inevitable. I mean, vertical integration is common, but so is vertical non-integration. There's an awful lot of companies that are not vertically integrated. And we have lots of examples in which vertical integration has failed. You know, Pepsi's acquisition of KFC and Pizza Hut. You know, of course, Coca-Cola has not merged with McDonald's. Sony Betamax, which was vertically integrated, was beat out by JVC. In cable, we've seen integration and disintegration occurring over time. You know, I note that even Alcoa, the fundamentally bad vertically integrated monopolist, has broken itself up into Alcoa and Arconic, upstream and downstream. So I think that's a similarity with horizontal as well. And finally, the key policy issue is the issue is not about whether or not there are efficiencies. The issue is whether the efficiencies are merger specific. And as I pointed out before, Coase stressed that you can get vertical integration by contract. Very often you can achieve the vertical efficiencies if they occur with contracts rather than having to merge. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about this unilateral. I don't want to talk about the guppy. We'll leave that as a homework assignment for you, but rather this idea that the firms are indirect competitors. So here's our basic story, and I've got an upstream merging firm, downstream merging firm. I've got them in green font. There's a downstream rival. And the way I've set this up, because I like to keep the harms and the benefits separate. You can have harms without benefits, you can have benefits without harms, or they can go together. So here, the upstream merging firm is simply supplying, in the pre-merger world, the downstream rival. And so since it supports the downstream rival, helps the downstream rival keep its costs low, well, and the downstream rival competes with a to-be downstream merging firm, you've got this competition implies that there's indirect competition at that level. Okay? And if there's a merger and the upstream merging firm raises the price to the downstream merging firm or cuts them off, that indirect competition is reduced or eliminated. And that's the sense in which a vertical merger can, purely unilaterally can reduce so-called horizontal competition. John, I sometimes focus on the fact that it would cut the rival off. John Baker focuses on the idea that it would raise the price of the downstream rival, and that would lead the downstream rival to involuntarily collude. In effect, it would be forced to coordinate with the downstream merging firms. Okay, so at the unilateral level, the issues are really not fundamentally different than in horizontal mergers, and that's why the guppies look similar. You can read this. This just says what I said in words rather than with the picture. At the level of coordination, vertical mergers can lead to coordination. One way it can lead to coordination is by disrupting or eliminating mavericks or disruptive buyers. So if the upstream merging firm is a maverick, after the merger, it may not want to behave as a maverick because its downstream partner benefited from, it may not want to eliminate coordination at the upstream level because if there gets to be coordination at the upstream level, it'll be the unintegrated rivals that get harmed. Meanwhile, its downstream merger partner will then have a cost advantage. So if the upstream merging firm is a maverick, it may no longer want to act like a maverick after the merger. Similarly, if the downstream merging firm is a disruptive buyer that prevents coordination at the upstream level, it won't want to do that after the merger. It would say, gee, why should I prevent coordination at the upstream level? I will be protected because I'll get my inputs from my partner, and it can raise the price to my downstream rivals. And then third, if there's a downstream maverick, non-emerging firm, well, that gives the upstream merging firm an even greater incentive to raise rivals' costs. So in those three ways, within the context of horizontal merger guidelines analysis, a vertical merger can lead to the same type of harms. There can be other coordinated harms as well. There can be the classic information exchange harm. It can encourage, within the context of unilateral, it can encourage reciprocal pricing or reciprocal coordination, which is a point I'll point you to my Yale article rather than talk about here. It's important, this issue of the reciprocal licensing, I think is important as a practical matter because with CNBC, NBCU merged with Comcast, and if Time Warner AT&T goes through, then you're going to have these two vertically integrated firms that will have an incentive to engage in reciprocal licensing. If there'll be another merger, right, when Charter buys Disney, you'll have three, or Verizon buys Disney, and then you'll have an incentive for them to use cross-licensing of their content in order to raise their own costs and thereby push up subscription prices. So, I think that's a retrospective we might want to do going forward to see what happens to the cable industry. In terms of efficiencies, this is where the controversy is. Both horizontal and vertical mergers can lead to mergers specific efficiencies. I agree with that. And as a result, many firms produce substitute products, whether it's from economies of scope, sharing information about customers, reputational goodwill, and the externalities that creates, and so on. But that's true for vertical mergers as well. Okay. Now, I don't think that the efficiencies are enough to call for a different approach for enforcement for vertical mergers in oligopoly markets. And so I lay out, these four bullets here. I don't think Bork carried the day. I don't think the econometrics carries the day. I don't think the fact that competitors complain carries the day. And I certainly don't think that Sylvania and Legion lead to that. And so I think once you accept the fact that these justifications are weak, it can refine the analysis and also avoid confirmation bias, both by merger analysts and by district courts. I'm not going to name names here, but you can name your own names about who suffers from confirmation bias. So let me go through this. Bork said foreclosure is just illusory. He had this great line that the FTC should have held an industry social mixer rather than bringing a vertical merger case. Well, I think we know at this point that foreclosure is real. There can be input foreclosure. There can be customer foreclosure. Markets do not inevitably self-correct, contrary to what Frank Easterbrook would like us to believe, especially if the conduct raises the cost of rivals or erects barriers to entry. We have examples of cartels with large numbers of members going on for a decade, vitamins, for example. So the self-correction idea, limited. And in exclusion, the reason why there's self-correction, it's argued, is because there'll be entry. But if the exclusion leads to barriers to entry, that doesn't work. So that fails. Single monopoly profit theory, no longer valid. It's valid in very, very limited circumstances where you have two monopolists, upstream monopolists, downstream monopolists, protected by durable barriers to entry. They have to be real monopolists, not because each one could be a potential entrant into the other's market. The fact that there's only one, we know, 100% market share does not necessarily imply that you've got monopoly power. As I keep saying, maybe if I say it often enough, you'll all believe it, elimination of double marginalization, EDM, is not inevitable and may not be merger specific. You know, it's hard to integrate. There are principal agent problems within the firm, incompatible technologies. But we'll talk about that a little more. Okay, so EDM. I think, you know, pretty much this, I've already probably laid out all these points. We can often achieve vertical merger efficiencies by contract without the potential anti-competitive harms. And that should be an issue in every vertical merger case. EDM is a wonderful story. It's just not inevitable, and it's not always merger specific. EDM can sometimes be eliminated with nonlinear prices or quantity forcing contracts. There are also EDM and the incentives to eliminate double marginalization is limited by opportunity costs, as we talk about in the Moresi-Salat paper. Key point, in my view, the failure to eliminate double marginalization in the pre-merger world does not prove merger specificity. The failure to achieve it could follow into the post-merger world as well. So what firms should need to justify why they couldn't eliminate elimination of double marginalization in the pre-merger world. Econometric evidence, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it in more detail later. Some studies are not capable of distinguishing. You know, a lot of studies actually show harm from vertical mergers. Gilbert and Hastings, Luco and Marshall. But we'll talk about them later. Some of the papers test the wrong theory, and of course they're limited by the data that's available. So we've got a lot of the evidence on vertical mergers is beer and cable because they've got good data. But the world's bigger than beer and cable. Complaints by downstream competitors, common story. If the merger reduces costs, competitors will complain, but the merger's good. If the merger will facilitate coordination, then competitors will not complain because they'll benefit. That means the merger's bad. Well, and sort of the, you know, my poster child for this is Posner's opinion in the Hospital Corporation of America. Posner said, the most telling argument for the merging firms is that the competitors complained. And we know competitor complaints are going the other direction. But what's interesting about that opinion is 4 pages earlier in the opinion, Posner said, the way anti-competitive harm will occur in this industry is that the leading firms will prevent entry by fringe, by new competitors or expansion by fringe by using certificate of need regulations to block their entry. So he laid out the very reason why the complaints by competitors actually were consistent with consumer welfare, yet he never linked it. He's a great man, but this may have been confirmation bias. You know, how do we explain that he missed that point? Sylvanian Legion, people argue, there are all these efficiencies from vertical restraints, and they should also lead to, what we know from them should lead to more permissive rules on vertical mergers. Well, I just point out that Sylvania was a manufacturer with 3% of the market in a competitive industry. Legion was in a competitive market as well. They were also intra-brand restraints, not inter-brand restraints like vertical mergers, and we know that inter-brand restraints are more problematic from a competitive point of view. And finally, despite the literature, what the Supreme Court said, and that's one of my sacred books as well, by the way, is the law, the Supreme Court did not mandate a permissive presumption for intra-brand vertical restraints. They said rule of reason, straight old rule of reason, which of course, essentially in decision theoretic terms, reflects a very neutral, competitively neutral presumption, not a pro-defendant presumption. So I think that's the basics on why we should not be more permissive with respect to vertical mergers. The legal context, I don't have a lot of time left. You know, I think that, let me just go here. I think we should basically be following the three-step rule of reason that's established in Baker Hughes and Hines for horizontal mergers. We should port that over to vertical mergers as well. That's the way Judge Leon wrote it in AT&T Time Warner. That's the way DOJ argued it in AT&T Time Warner. And I think that, you know, an important point here is that the standard of proof builds in a greater concern with false negatives than with false positives. That's what the Clayton Act is all about, incipiency in the Clayton Act. So that's another reason why, I think the vertical merger law should follow horizontal merger law. And, you know, I personally hope or expect that the D.C. Circuit is going to come out that way in AT&T Time Warner. I note here in sort of the really crucial point in terms of the policy discussion that we've been having of where do you put the efficiencies in horizontal mergers, in the standard rule of reason across all of antitrust, efficiencies are step two. They're part of the rebuttal case. The plaintiff needs to show harm. If the plaintiff can show harm, then the burden shifts to the defendant to show some merger-specific, or in the case of restraint-specific efficiencies. If the defendant successfully shows that, then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff to carry the burden of persuasion that there is net anti-competitive effect. So step one, harm analysis, is ignoring efficiencies, is there likely harm? Then step two says, well, there are efficiencies. Then step three says, okay, how do you balance the effect on consumers from step one and step two? And the people argue that you shouldn't follow this because vertical mergers are inherently highly efficient and pro-competitive. Well, I've answered why I don't think that's right. Another argument is that you can't have a Philadelphia National Bank presumption because the HHI doesn't rise in horizontal mergers. But, you know, this three-step rule of reason you can do without a presumption. It's done in the rule of reason without a presumption. And you can do it here without a presumption. Or you can create a presumption using different elements. Presumptions don't have to be increasing the HHI. And I've got a slide that talks about possible presumptions in vertical mergers. I note that the DOJ no longer thinks what they thought in 1984. These are the DOJ's proposed conclusions of law in the AT&T case. And I've underlined the ones that I think are notable. So they buy into the idea of incipiency. They say the relevant standard should be reasonable probability. They say you should use the same Section 7 standard for vertical and horizontal. They'd say you should not have to quantify up to the fourth decimal point. They say you should follow burden shifting, use the burden shifting rule, and the burden is on the defendant to show efficiencies, and the efficiencies only count if they're merger specific. Okay. So how would we do that? Well, in this limited amount of time, I just want to point you to the bottom set of bullets, which are possible presumptions that you might use in vertical mergers. For example, one merging firm is dominant and the other is a critical entry, supplies a critical entry, or the upstream firm's a maverick, the downstream merging firm is a disruptive buyer. I want to emphasize these presumptions are presumption. The way the law works is there are presumptions, and then there's case-specific evidence. So these are presumptions that would affect the step one analysis. So they're presumptions about harm, not presumptions about net competitive benefit after you take potential efficiencies into account. Okay. So I think the arguments against these presumptions are all, well, there's efficiencies. Well, there's efficiencies. Well, there's efficiencies. Okay, but step one is ignoring efficiencies. what's the likely effect. So I also, you know, I think there can be safe harbors as well. In my paper with Dan Culley, we suggest a safe harbor if the HHIs in both markets fall into the safe harbor, if both markets are unconcentrated. And we have an adjustment there that not just the plain old HHI, but also an HHI adjusted for if you take out the merging firms, is the HHI also unconcentrated, since foreclosure sometimes eliminates competition by the merging firms. Okay, there'd be two kinds of rebuttals: the usual structural rebuttal, no barriers to entry, et cetera, or there's the efficiency rebuttals. And I've already talked about the fact that I think merger specific, verifiable. Two interesting issues. Maybe I'll take 1 minute over just to introduce them. What if there's only harm to some competitors? To some consumers, but not others. So, for example, in the FTC, the FTC did a consent decree on these two soft drink bottler mergers. A study by Luco and Marshall said, as a result of this, the price of Coke and Pepsi went down, but because they're bottlers, bottle for Snapple and or Dr. Pepper and 7-Up, the prices of Dr. Pepper and 7-Up went up. So in that merger, is that merger okay or not okay if you knew that? Well, some people would say you should, you know, just look at some kind of representative consumer that drinks both. But under merger law, usually you can define a market for a targeted customer market, a price discrimination market. And in that case, the harm to the 7-Up and Dr. Pepper consumers would define a relevant market, and that's cognizable harm. And if there's harm in any relevant market, then the merger violates Section 7. So you'd have to, no cross-market balancing, says Philadelphia National Bank and its progeny. So that raises an issue whether we should follow that. And then lastly, what if there's harm to the downstream competitors? And yes, that's harm to competitors, but they're also customers. So is that enough, or do we need to show harm to the ultimate consumers? And that's a policy question. Interestingly, DOJ said it's enough to show harm to the other cable companies, to the mid-level people, to the competitors, that you didn't need to show harm to consumers. Though, in fact, they in their argument, their factual analysis, they claimed there was harm to consumers. So I just sort of leave that out. Maybe we'll talk about it more, just sort of to let you think this is not totally stupid. Suppose the merger facilitates collusion among the upstream firms. Well, then should you have to prove harm to all the way downstream, or should it be enough to show harm to their customers? Good question. So remedy, we no need to talk about remedy. So in my view, new guidelines are needed, and they should follow Baker Hughes, and they should follow the policies that I've suggested. Thank you.